This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Well, the President of the United States is obviously in all sorts of legal difficulty. They are political problems, but they are also legal problems. So we need some legal advice. And what better source for legal advice than a former U.S. attorney? Our sole guest today is former U.S. Attorney Paul Charlton. Welcome to the Think Tank.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Let's rewind to the beginning, just in case somebody doesn't know. What exactly is a U.S. attorney?
The U.S. attorney is the presidentially appointed representative of the Department of Justice in the district where he or she serves. And for example, here in Arizona, you would be the U.S. attorney for the District of Arizona.
And that's the function you held, is that correct?
It is the position I held, yes.
And when was that?
From 2001 to January of 2007.
Okay, so you were a President George W. Bush appointee as U.S. attorney for the state of Arizona.
Yes.
Okay, some legal questions. It seems to be the case that there's general agreement, though not total consensus, that a president cannot be indicted while in office. Is that a settled matter?
As to the law, it is probably unsettled. As to the Department of Justice policy, it seems to be settled. The policy from the Department of Justice, as spoken and as written, is that presidents ought not to be charged while they hold office. Now, that doesn't mean they can't be, under that same policy, charged once they leave office. But if this Department of Justice follows that policy, it means it is unlikely that this president will be charged with a crime while he sits in that office.
Does that mean even the indictment could not come down? I mean, could somebody be indicted, a president be indicted, and then it doesn't take an effect until after he leaves office, or even the actual charging doesn't occur?
It's a great technical question. The only reason that I can see that a prosecutor such as Bob Mueller might wish to bring the charges but not proceed with the charges would be to try to avoid a statute of limitations problem. As you probably know, Mike, most federal offenses have a 5-year statute of limitations, and to the extent that any of these alleged wrongdoings took place before 5 years or within that statute of limitations, there may be some temptation by the special prosecutor to bring charges. But again, what is clear under DOJ policy is the president would not be tried.
Well, I hadn't thought of the statute of limitations, so that could be if absent a sort of a pre-indictment indictment, you know, indictment now to be in effect later, that could almost be a get out of jail free or a de facto exemption from prosecution.
It is a problem. Again, we don't know all of the issues that the special counsel is looking at, but to the extent that Bob Mueller is looking at issues that may be coming close to that statute of limitation, it's going to present a problem for him.
Now, technically, isn't it true that the special or any prosecutor doesn't really indict? They go to a grand jury, they suggest indictment, and the grand jury issues the indictment. Is that correct?
That's right. And it is an important distinction that if there were to be charges here, 23 citizens would sit in a grand jury and make the determination as to whether or not there was probable cause to believe that a crime had occurred.
Now, clarify, a grand jury, are grand juries selected by the same means as regular juries?
They certainly are. And if you live, for example, in this state, and in this county, you are just as likely to be selected to serve on a grand jury, which is, as you just said, the body that decides whether or not someone could be charged with a crime, as you may be called to serve on a petit jury. That's the jury that decides whether you're guilty of the crime. Two different juries doing two different things, but all part of our obligation as Americans.
Now, I was recently called in as a juror. And the first thing we were hit with is this is going to be a 3-month trial. This is after they said most trials take a week. And of course, when you said 3-month trial, all of a sudden people had all sorts of reasons why they couldn't do it legitimately.
Sure.
Now, isn't it true that a grand jury typically doesn't meet just for one short period of time? They often meet like a day here and there over a period of months or even years.
Typically, for example, in this district, as we were talking about the federal districts, they meet once a month, and they can do so for a year and extend to over 2 years. And it's their charge to listen to all manner of crimes in this state, so everything from illegal entry to public corruption.
Now, how 23 jurors, is that then a panel that then is that subsetted that? Who makes so you got 23 jurors? They're all voting on indictment, all 23?
That's correct. And as opposed to a Pettit jury, the jury that decides guilt or innocence, which, as you know, has to be a unanimous verdict. We just saw that in the Gates trial. The Manafort trial a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, 11-1.
Not 11-1, right. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have a unanimous verdict, then you don't get a guilty finding. The grand jury only needs a majority vote. So of that 23, if the majority vote in favor of finding probable cause, then an indictment will be returned by the grand jury. And that's been cause for much criticism in the legal community and outside of the legal community, because the concern is that only having to show probable cause and only having to get a majority of the jurors is too simple for a prosecutor. It's too easy for a prosecutor to bring charges, but that is the system that we currently have.
And I apologize. I know this is like way below your pay grade, but you used a phrase there, probable cause. I think for the average listener, that needs an explanation.
Of course. So there are standards of proof in the American criminal justice system. The lowest, easiest standard of proof to meet is probable cause. That means it is probable, not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but just probable that a crime has been committed. It means that you can present hearsay. It means that, for example, on a drug conspiracy charge, one DEA agent can testify about the statements made by many witnesses without having to call the other witnesses. It is a very low standard of proof, and it is much different than proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what the prosecutors would have to prove in order to obtain a conviction. And as we just said, they'd have to prove it to a unanimous verdict, which is to say every single member of the jury would have to agree that there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt before the individual would be convicted of a crime.
So it is enough to get things moving, but it is a barrier if there's really sketchy evidence that you have to pass by.
That's right. So our founding fathers borrowed this idea from England when they drafted the Constitution. They wanted citizens to stand between the government and being charged. And while there is, as we said, a great deal of criticism about how easy it can be to charge somebody, you don't have to go too far back into this state's history to remember that there was once a county attorney by the name of Andrew Thomas, and one of his deputies attempted to charge individuals with a crime, and the grand jurors refused to allow the prosecution to go forward. They issued what's known as a no bill. They rejected the invitation, if you will, by Andrew Thomas and one of his deputies to charge one of his political enemies. And that is an example of the grand jury working as it was designed to do.
Now, that's pretty rare, isn't it?
It is rare indeed. But it is heartening in the sense that if that is the core purpose, we can point to at least one example here where that works. There are, as I say, many other people who will say too often prosecutors obtain indictments too quickly and too easily.
The phrase that you often hear is that I could indict a ham sandwich.
It's true. And that's where finding ethical and good prosecutors becomes so very important. Because if you are of a mind to pursue your political enemies, for example, there can be instances in which you could convince a grand jury to charge someone. There's a wonderful history lesson for prosecutors, and you'll see this often in almost every prosecution office throughout the country. A great former attorney general of FDR by the name of Jackson, who went on to be a Supreme Court justice. Jackson said that we had to be careful as prosecutors. Can you imagine? This is 1940, Mike. He said, we have to be careful as prosecutors because you have to first find the crime and then look for the individual who committed the crime. If you reverse that chronology and say, I've found an individual I want to charge, it's probably pretty easy to find a crime that anybody has committed just by looking deeply enough into their past.
That was some of the hit against the Clinton prosecution.
That's exactly right.
Okay. We're running way over. We'll pick up this conversation in just a moment in the think tank. We're meeting with former U.S. Attorney Paul Charlton. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are discussing legal issues relating to the president with Paul Charlton, former U.S. attorney for the state of Arizona. Question, what if the special prosecutor Mueller were to send a subpoena to Trump to testify? Has a court ruled on whether or not we have a definitive answer to whether or not a president can be compelled to testify?
I think the current state of the law, as you look at what happened with President Clinton, as you look at what happened to President Nixon, is that subpoenas issued to presidents are valid. What has been much in the news more recently, and if you've been following the Kavanaugh hearings at all, is whether or not we ought to subject presidents to ongoing investigations. And there is some thoughtful debate, whether you agree one side or the other, about whether or not we ought to allow presidents to be subject to these kinds of investigations.
So precedent would certainly suggest Clinton testified, for example. That's precedent, but probably not a legally binding one.
It is precedent, right? It may not be legally binding. We know, for example, that President Nixon did, in fact, turn over the Watergate tapes that were subpoenaed. That was the cause of Archibald Cox being fired and so many individuals resigning during the Saturday night massacre.
And a 9-0 Supreme Court decision, as I recall, on that one.
That's right. That's right. So it would be difficult to say for the Supreme Court that we do not wish to subject the president to this kind of investigation. But there have, as I say, been suggestions by others in the legal community that the Congress ought to seek to protect the president from investigations while he is seated in office. And I suspect that is the same theory that underlies the Department of Justice policy, which says you cannot bring a president to trial while he sits in the office.
And that was a law article written by the current Supreme Court nominee Kavanaugh, was it not, that said
it was
suggested that Congress should act to do that.
That's exactly right. So an interesting history for Judge Kavanaugh and likely to be Justice Kavanaugh. Is his view, after having served on Ken Starr's special prosecution team that investigated Clinton, President Clinton, then President Clinton, he, Kavanaugh, said that upon reflection, he did not think, in his own personal view, that it was appropriate to subject presidents to that kind of investigation. But he also recognized, as you pointed out, that if that is going to change, then Congress needs to change the law.
Which it has not.
Correct. The current state of the law is that the president can still be investigated, and we, of course, know that to be true based upon our present history.
Well, move on just a minute here. I mean, one of the most striking events in this whole process in the last couple of weeks has been the conviction of Paul Manafort and the Cohen, Cohen being the president's personal attorney, plea and evident cooperation with prosecutors. What was Manafort convicted of?
Manafort was convicted of bank fraud, and just as we were discussing earlier, there were a number of charges for which he was not convicted because there was one lone holdout juror who did not believe that there was probable cause. But at the end of the day, the sentences for those charges for which he was found guilty are sufficient enough that I think you would have to say that the prosecution won the day as it relates to that trial. He, as you know, Mike, is facing yet another trial at the end of this month for charges relating to his alleged failure to register as a foreign agent.
Now, neither of these really relate directly to President Trump. Is that correct?
The prosecutors have been very clear to say so. They said so multiple times during the trial that Mr. Manafort faced in Virginia, and they have said so publicly in this next trial that will take place in the District of Columbia.
Now, on the other hand, my assumption has been the role of this is that if you have enough stuff hanging over your head, you might be enticed to cooperate with the investigation of the 2016 election.
The idea of charging individuals and to then seek their cooperation is a lawful and accepted tactic that has been used by prosecutors for well over 200 years. I suspect that you are correct that if Mr. Manafort, and he's shown no such inclination so far, but if Mr. Manafort were willing to cooperate with the government, they would welcome that cooperation.
And offer him some sort of consideration in terms of sentencing in exchange.
That's correct, Mike. That's correct. That's typically how it works. You are given some consideration in exchange for the information you give. The greater the impact of the information you share with the prosecution, the greater the likelihood that your sentence will be reduced.
Now, I saw at least some reports that he was trying to negotiate for something in terms of the second trial.
That's right. The news reported that both Mr. Manafort's trial lawyers and the prosecutors at trial were discussing a plea, but that Mr. Mueller rejected that idea.
What? Real quick, you've got about 30 seconds. What inference do you draw from Mueller rejecting that?
That he didn't like whatever the offer was, and he wants to proceed and go forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We will be back. We're talking with Paul Charlton, former U.S. attorney, about the president's various legal difficulties from a legal more than a political perspective. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are talking with former U.S. attorney for the state of Arizona, Paul Charlton, was a Bush appointee and served in the beginning of 2000. I think you said 2001, 2006, something like that.
That is correct, yes.
Cohen, the president's personal attorney, has taken a plea and is cooperating with the special prosecutor. His knowledge would seem to be more directly related to potential crimes. And the other thing, I suppose, in that same area, the CFO, the Trump Organization, seems also to be cooperating, though he's not been charged with anything at this point. What do you think are the significance of these two cooperators, basically?
It's probably important here, Mike, to talk about an important distinction between the Cohen prosecutors and the prosecutors who are involved, for example, in the Manafort case. Early on in the Cohen case, Bob Mueller's team turned this prosecution over to the prosecutors in the Southern District of New York. That's the flagship U.S. Attorney's Office in the United States. It's the place where
financial crimes, right?
Financial
it's Wall
crimes,
Street.
Martha Stewart, more of sort of infamously, but also significant terrorism cases. The blind sheik, who was responsible for the first bombing of the World Trade Centers, as you'll recall. So high-profile, difficult, complex prosecutions typically take place there. Very qualified, very bright prosecutors. It is those prosecutors, not Bob Mueller, who were responsible for the Cohen plea, and I suspect the distinction lies in the facts of the crime, which Cohen admitted to, and those are essentially election law violations. They did not deal with Russian meddling with the United States elections, and so Bob Mueller and his team were not involved, although, as I understand it, they were present in the courtroom with the public when Mr. Cohen pled guilty.
Uh-huh. And by the way, that is the office, the U.S. Attorney, Southern District of New York. That was Rudy Giuliani had that job at one point, didn't he?
That's exactly right. He had that job once and was very well respected, and it caused no small amount of concern within that office when he started to call those prosecutors stormtroopers because, as you'll recall, the FBI, with the permission of those prosecutors, seized records from Mr. Cohen, the lawyer for President Trump.
Yeah, these are the very people that he worked with when he held that role. Maybe not, you know, it's a generation ago, so maybe not the individual people, but certainly the office.
Precisely, and there was some unhappiness within that office and those office, that office's alumni about his use of that word.
Now, the U.S. Attorney for Southern District in New York, did they report to Rosenstein or to the Attorney General?
That person who holds that position is a presidentially appointed U.S. attorney. You'll recall that Preet Bharara, who was appointed by Obama, was fired by President Trump, and President Trump replaced him with his United States attorney. So this is a Republican, a prosecutor who was appointed by President Trump, and yes, that's correct, Mike. He reports to the Deputy Attorney General. That is his chain of command, Rod Rosenstein.
Is that because the Attorney General has recused himself, or is that the normal chain of command that you report to the Deputy Attorney General?
That is the normal chain of command.
Okay, so that's an entirely different group of people.
It is, but I think we can expect that if there is information that Mr. Cohen has that would be relevant to Mr. Mueller's investigation for the reasons we just talked about, because Mr. Cohen is now facing a significant amount of time in prison, that if he has something to offer that would benefit the Mueller team would likely work with the folks at the Southern District of New York to seek a reduced sentence for the information that Mr. Cohen may be able to provide. There's been some debate, as you know, in the media as to whether or not Mr. Cohen has any information that would be of assistance to the special prosecutor. He, Mr. Cohen, has said, and said so under oath during the change of plea, that he committed these election law violations at the direction of the president, but that is much different than Russian meddling.
But it's still a criminal offense.
Most certainly is a felony, and he'll go to prison for a significant amount of time for having pled guilty to those crimes.
Well, and if the president directed it, that would seem to be a crime too. Is that right?
It may be. His lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, as you pointed out, the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, has argued vociferously that it is not a crime. And for technical reasons, it may not be.
Uh-huh.
But that, again, is unlikely to be decided while the president sits in office because of the Department of Justice policy that indicates the presidents should not be charged while they sit in that office.
Now, let me ask you about another potential collaboration, and that is between either Mueller or the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District and state prosecutors. The significance of that being that the president has a pretty wide pardoning power, but only for federal offenses. When you were U.S. attorney, did you ever cooperate with the state attorney general or any of the other state or local level agencies in sharing information?
Well, that raises two very interesting issues. As you know, the president has talked and provided pardons to a number of individuals. Our former sheriff, Joe Arpaio, was the beneficiary of one of those pardons. There's even been some talk and some debate about whether or not the president could pardon himself. And so, yes, to the second part of that question, it is right and appropriate for a U.S. attorney's office, for federal prosecutors, to seek to cooperate with their state and local partners. There are oftentimes, and it wouldn't be hard to imagine when that would occur, for example, on large drug conspiracies, for example, or interstate trafficking of drugs or homicides, where you would want to work with your state and local partners. So those channels, those relationships pre-exist within the law enforcement community, and so it would not be unusual, for example, the State Attorney General of New York or the Manhattan District Attorney's Office to have good working relationships with the Southern District of New York or even the prosecutors on Bob Mueller's team.
So this is something that's done. This is not unusual.
It is not unusual. What makes all of this unusual are the allegations that relate to Russian meddling.
Of course. But one other thing, though, occurred to me that obviously is, or I would think is obvious, involves state level. If someone is guilty of federal tax evasion, it's almost impossible not to be guilty of state tax evasion. Isn't that correct? Because if you're in a state that has state income tax, you base your state income tax on your federal return.
Well, because there are some complexities that relate to tax laws and different tax laws, maybe the easier example, Mike, is if I possess for distribution 100 kilos of cocaine, I would easily be subject to prosecution in the state system, at the county system, and in the federal system. All three of those jurisdictions would have jurisdiction over the crime of distribution of cocaine.
And that's not double jeopardy because they're different crimes in different jurisdictions.
That's precisely right, Mike. It's very good. We'll have to give you an honorary JD by the time we're done with this.
So the president has tweeted, I don't have it in front of me, but said basically the attorney general shouldn't prosecute somebody. If that is there... Could that be a component of obstruction of justice if you're basically trying to interfere with the prosecutorial process?
I don't know as it relates to that scenario that it would constitute obstruction of justice. But here is the concern about criticizing federal prosecutors for investigating or charging individuals of any party. Justice is supposed to be blind. And having worked in that institution for more than 16 years, what I know is that the men and women of the U.S. Attorney's Office, while they hold different political beliefs, are of a singular mind when it comes to prosecuting crimes, regardless of someone's political affiliation. So it is incorrect, I think, and inaccurate to say that those prosecutors were targeting individuals because of their political beliefs. Lay people may sometimes believe that the Department of Justice, because it serves presidents of different political parties, may seek to prosecute individuals who are members of the opposite party. But it is my experience that by and large, with some rare exceptions, those line assistant U.S. attorneys are doing their job to the very best of their ability and without regard to someone's political affiliation.
As U.S. attorney, were you ever asked to do prosecute or not prosecute on the basis of what felt to you to be a political basis?
I was never asked to prosecute anybody, but I did get the sense that when we were prosecuting former Congressman Rick Renzi, we were running into some obstacles in that regard because he was a Republican. And
how did you feel that? I mean, some obstacles. What led you to believe that, or how did that?
Well, the prosecution, because if you're looking at a congressman for alleged crimes, there are times when you need to get Department of Justice approval for certain law enforcement techniques.
For example, a wiretap or something like that.
Precisely.
Uh-huh.
Precisely. Those are typically handled with dispatch. They're handled relatively quickly, as you can imagine, if you're trying to get up on a wire for a drug conspiracy or a cartel. Those things are done very quickly. There was some feeling within the office that we were being slow-walked as it related to a wiretap investigation there. But at the end of the day, again, justice was done. Mr. Renzi was convicted of the crimes for which he was charged, and he served time in prison. I am satisfied that the right thing was done there by the career men and women in that office, that was an investigation done and initiated under a Republican administration, the conviction took place under a Republican administration as well. So, and he was a Republican congressman. By and large, as I say, and with some rare exception, because these are institutions inhabited by human beings and human beings are fallible, these men and women are out to do the right thing, and they generally do.
Okay, we'll be back. We'll conclude this. I want to ask you about the likely content and format of the Mueller report. And when we be back in just a moment, we will conclude our discussion with Paul Charlton, former U.S. attorney. Thank you.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're discussing legal issues as it relates to the president's situation with one of the most astute observers of the process you could imagine. The guest is Paul Charlton. He was U.S. attorney for the state of Arizona. So he's been involved in things, I was going to say just like this. No, there's probably nothing quite just like a potential legal entanglement of the president of the United States. We haven't seen this in about 50 years. So nothing's exactly like this, but certainly been involved in the process. I want to ask you about the Mueller report. And I want to say, put it this way, how free is he in terms of format? I could see one of two possible formats, and they vary according to how explicit or implicit the conclusion is. Option one would be, here's all this evidence, blah, 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 and then Congress can read in exactly what it wants. Or option two could be, here's all this evidence, and there, as a result, there's clear evidence of, or is not, is or is not clear evidence of serious criminal wrongdoing. If Donald Trump were not president, we might, for example, expect to obtain multiple indictments or not. In other words, differing in the degree to which the conclusion is made explicit. Is he the format of, he's supposed to issue a quote-unquote report, is there precedent? Is it up to him what that format looks like?
I suspect he has great discretion in the format. But at the end of the day, as you described it, it is likely to be very much as you just described it, which is to say there's a possibility, we don't know whether it will or not, but there's a possibility that he may identify crimes that have occurred. Number one. Number two, he may identify what the Constitution recognizes as high crimes and misdemeanors, which is to say information that Congress may wish to use in determining whether or not it wishes to impeach the president of the United States. It may marry those two conclusions and find crimes and other issues that the Congress may wish to use. There's a third possibility, of course, that he may find that there was no wrongdoing as it relates to the president. All of those possibilities are certainly very real.
Now, the problem that I see with part of the high crimes and misdemeanors, I've never seen that defined. And the only explanation I've ever heard is that that's whatever Congress wants it to be. Is there a definition?
No, that's a wonderful degree of latitude for Congress, though, isn't it? Because that is exactly correct. High crimes and misdemeanors are what the Congress decides it will be. You don't have to go too far back, and we were just talking about the Ken Starr investigation, to know that that in large part involved the president's dealings with an intern, much different than what that investigation started out to look at. The president, as you know, was not charged with any crimes as it relates to the Ken Starr investigation, but was impeached in the House at the time. So there is at least something that the Mueller team can look at if they wish to look at the Starr investigation and determine what the format looks like. But it is, as you pointed out, Mike, the conclusions, which are going to be much more important than the format.
And this gets into the political side. I look at if he goes with the former, which is, okay, here we got all this evidence and here's what all the evidence is, and doesn't have an explicit conclusion, then we probably don't move off of where we are right now, which is that will be viewed through a partisan lens and the Republicans will have a clear path to saying, well, nothing's conclusive, end of the matter.
I know Bob Mueller and certainly the public can know of him by his reputation. And whatever findings he makes, I think we can be certain that there will be conclusions, that there will be specific findings. Again, within that broad spectrum of possibilities that we talked about, nothing happened, something perhaps not criminal happened or something criminal happened. But I suspect there will be findings in the report.
Well, let me ask about him a little bit, if you know him. From all I've seen in terms of biography, he is about as straight an arrow as you will find anywhere.
An extraordinary career and an extraordinary individual, a decorated combat Marine, Silver Star in Vietnam, volunteered to go to Vietnam, and then was a career prosecutor, went into private practice for a period of time and found it unsatisfactory, went back to the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, where they offered him a supervisory role, and he said, that's not what I want. I want to prosecute homicide cases. Went back, prosecuted homicide cases, and then was promoted within the Department of Justice to a number of positions. He was sort of a U.S. attorney who went around the country to assist U.S. attorney's offices that were troubled. He was in San Francisco for a period of time. He was in Boston for a period of time. And then, as you know, ran the FBI soon after 9/11. And he has had an impeccable career. No one has ever questioned his ethics with any real success that I know of. There may be political voices now who are trying to do so, but I know him to be about as squared away an individual as you could find.
Let me, as a concluding question, and we have just a hair over a minute left, you have a unique perspective on all of this, having been on the inside of the Justice Department in a relevant role. What do you expect to happen?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know the answer. There have already been 32 indictments, and there have been a number of high-profile plea agreements. I suspect we're going to see more indictments, more pleas, but at the end of the day, will that ever reach the White House? I don't think we know the answer today.
No, one thing's for sure. Yeah, that he seems to be extremely methodical, extremely careful. And my observation from day one, whatever's going to happen, it's not going to happen quickly.
Although I will say, for an investigation of this sort of technical, difficult piece, it is moving quickly by those standards.
Actually, yeah, if you compare this to Clinton or almost any other prior thing of this magnitude, is actually moving more quickly.
Light speed.
Even though that isn't quick. It's relatively speaking, it's quickly.
Correct.
Thank you very much. Paul Charlton, former U.S. attorney. This has been very insightful. We thank you for your time. We'll see you next week in the Think Tank.